This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Journey to East Lan, The Lessons of Don Juan, by Carlos Castaneda, narrated by Luis Moreno.
Introduction. On Saturday, May 22, 1971, I went to Sonora, Mexico, to see Don Juan Matus, a Yaqui Indian sorcerer, with whom I had been associated since 1961. I thought that my visit on that day was going to be in no way different from the scores of times I had gone to see him in the 10 years I had been his apprentice. The events that took place on that day and on the following days, however, were momentous to me. On that occasion, my apprenticeship came to an end. This was not an arbitrary withdrawal on my part, but a bona fide termination. I've already presented the case of my apprenticeship in two previous works, The Teachings of Don Juan and A Separate Reality. My basic assumption in both books has been that the articulation points in learning to be a sorcerer were the states of non-ordinary reality produced by the ingestion of psychotropic plants. In this respect, Don Juan was an expert in the use of three such plants: Datura inoxia, commonly known as Jimson weed, Lophophora williamsii, known as peyote, and a hallucinogenic mushroom of the genus psilocybe. My perception of the world through the effects of those psychotropics had been so bizarre and impressive that I was forced to assume that such states were the only avenue to communicating and learning what Don Juan was attempting to teach me. That assumption was erroneous. For the purpose of avoiding any misunderstandings about my work with Don Juan, I would like to clarify the following issues at this point. So far, I have made no attempt whatsoever to place Don Juan in a cultural milieu. The fact that he considers himself to be a Yaqui Indian doesn't mean that his knowledge of sorcery is known to or practiced by the Yaqui Indians in general. All the conversations that Don Juan and I have had throughout the apprenticeship were conducted in Spanish, and only because of his thorough command of the language was I capable of obtaining complex explanations of his system of beliefs. I've maintained the practice of referring to that system as sorcery, and I've also maintained the practice of referring to Don Juan as a sorcerer, because these were categories he himself used. Since I was capable of writing down most of what he said in the beginning of the apprenticeship and everything that was said in the later phases of it, I gathered voluminous field notes. In order to render those notes readable and still preserve the dramatic unity of Don Juan's teachings, I've had to edit them, but what I've deleted is, I believe, immaterial to the points I want to raise. In the case of my work with Don Juan, I've limited my efforts solely to viewing him as a sorcerer and to acquiring membership in his knowledge. For the purpose of presenting my argument, I must first explain the basic premise of sorcery as Don Juan presented it to me. He said that for a sorcerer, the world of everyday life is not real, or out there, as we believe it is. For a sorcerer, reality, or the world we all know, is only a description. For the sake of validating this premise, Don Juan concentrated the best of his efforts into leading me to a genuine conviction that what I held in mind as the world at hand was merely a description of the world, a description that had been pounded into me from the moment I was born. He pointed out that everyone who comes into contact with a child is a teacher who incessantly describes the world to him, until the moment when the child is capable of perceiving the world as it is described. According to Don Juan, we have no memory of that portentous moment, simply because none of us could possibly have had any point of reference to compare it to anything else. From that moment on, however, the child is a member. He knows the description of the world, and his membership becomes full-fledged, I suppose, when he is capable of making all the proper perceptual interpretations, which, by conforming to that description, validate it. For Don Juan, then, the reality of our day-to-day life consists of an endless flow of perceptual interpretations, which we, the individuals who share a specific membership, have learned to make in common. The idea that the perceptual interpretations that make up the world have a flow is congruous with the fact that they run uninterruptedly and are rarely, if ever, open to question. In fact, the reality of the world we know is so taken for granted that the basic premise of sorcery, that our reality is merely one of many descriptions, could hardly be taken as a serious proposition. Fortunately, in the case of my apprenticeship, Don Juan was not concerned at all with whether or not I could take his proposition seriously, and he proceeded to elucidate his points in spite of my opposition, my disbelief, and my inability to understand what he was saying. Thus, as a teacher of sorcery, Don Juan endeavored to describe the world to me from the very first time we talked. My difficulty in grasping his concepts and methods stemmed from the fact that the units of his description were alien and incompatible with those of my own. His contention was that he was teaching me how to see, as opposed to merely looking, and that stopping the world was the first step to seeing. For years, I had treated the idea of stopping the world as a cryptic metaphor that really didn't mean anything. It was only during an informal conversation that took place towards the end of my apprenticeship that I came to fully realize its scope and importance as one of the main propositions of Don Juan's knowledge. Don Juan and I had been talking about different things in a relaxed and unstructured manner. I told him about a friend of mine and his dilemma with his 9-year-old son. The child, who'd been living with the mother for the past 4 years, was then living with my friend, and the problem was what to do with him. According to my friend, the child was a misfit in school. He lacked concentration and wasn't interested in anything. He was given to tantrums, disruptive behavior, and to running away from home. "Your friend certainly does have a problem," Don Juan said, laughing. I wanted to keep on telling him all the terrible things the child had done, but he interrupted me. "There's no need to say any more about that poor little boy," he said. "There's no need for you or for me to regard his actions in our thoughts one way or another." His manner was abrupt, and his tone was firm, but then he smiled. "What can my friend do?" I asked. "The worst thing he could do is to force the child to agree with him," Don Juan said. "What do you mean?" "I mean that that child shouldn't be spanked or scared by his father when he doesn't behave the way he wants him to." "How can he teach him anything if he isn't firm with him?" "Your friend should let someone else spank the child." "He can't let anyone else touch his little boy," I said, surprised at his suggestion. Don Juan seemed to enjoy my reaction and giggled. "Your friend is not a warrior," he said. "If he were, he would know that the worst thing one can do is to confront human beings bluntly." "What does a warrior do, Don Juan?" "A warrior proceeds strategically." "I still don't understand what you mean." "I mean that if your friend were a warrior, he would help his child to stop the world." "How can my friend do that?" "He would need personal power. He would need to be a sorcerer." "But he isn't." "In that case, you must use ordinary means to help his son to change his idea of the world. It's not stopping the world, but it'll work just the same." I asked him to explain his statements. "If I were your friend," Don Juan said, "I would start by hiring someone to spank the little guy. I would go to Skid Row and hire the worst-looking man I could find. To scare a little boy? Not just to scare a little boy, you fool. That little fellow must be stopped, and being beaten by his father won't do it. If one wants to stop our fellow men, one must always be outside the circle that presses them. That way, one can always direct the pressure. The idea was preposterous, but somehow it was appealing to me. Don Juan was resting his chin on his left palm. His left arm was propped against his chest on a wooden box that served as a low table. His eyes were closed, but his eyeballs moved. I felt he was looking at me through his eyelids. The thought scared me. "Tell me more about what my friend should do with his little boy," I said.
"Tell him to go to Skid Row, and very carefully select an ugly-looking derelict," he went on. "Tell him to get a young one, one who still has some strength left in him."
Don Juan then delineated a strange strategy. I was to instruct my friend to have the man follow him or wait for him at a place where he would go with his son. The man, in response to a prearranged cue to be given after any objectionable behavior on the part of the child, was supposed to leap from a hiding place, pick the child up, and spank the living daylights out of him.
After the man scares him, your friend must help the little boy regain his confidence in any way he can. If he follows this procedure 3 or 4 times, I assure you that that child will feel differently towards everything. He will change his idea of the world.
What if the fright injures him?
Fright never injures anyone. What injures the spirit is having someone always on your back, beating you, telling you what to do and what not to do. When that boy is more contained, you must tell your friend to do one last thing for him. He must find some way to get to a dead child, perhaps in a hospital or at the office of a doctor. He must take his son there and show the dead child to him. He must let him touch the corpse once with his left hand on any place except the corpse's belly. After the boy does that, he'll be renewed. The world will never be the same for him.
I realized then that throughout the years of our association, Don Juan had been employing with me, although on a different scale, the same tactics he was suggesting my friend should use with his son. I asked him about it. He said that he'd been trying all along to teach me how to stop the world.
"You haven't yet," he said, smiling. "Nothing seems to work, because you're very stubborn. If you were less stubborn, however, by now, you'd probably have stopped the world with any of the techniques I've taught you."
"What techniques, Don Juan?"
"Everything I have told you to do was a technique for stopping the world."
A few months after that conversation, Don Juan accomplished what he had set out to do, to teach me to stop the world. That monumental event in my life compelled me to re-examine in detail my work of 10 years. It became evident to me that my original assumption about the role of psychotropic plants was erroneous. They weren't the essential feature of the sorcerer's description of the world, but were only an aid to cement, so to speak, parts of the description which I'd been incapable of perceiving otherwise. My insistence on holding on to my standard version of reality rendered me almost deaf and blind to Don Juan's aims. Therefore, it was simply my lack of sensitivity which had fostered their use. In reviewing the totality of my field notes, I became aware that Don Juan had given me the bulk of the new description at the very beginning of our association in what he called techniques for stopping the world. I had discarded those parts of my field notes in my earlier works because they didn't pertain to the use of psychotropic plants. I've now rightfully reinstated them in the total scope of Don Juan's teachings, and they comprise the first 17 chapters of this work. The last three chapters are the field notes covering the events that culminated in my stopping the world. In summing up, I can say that when I began the apprenticeship, there was another reality. That is to say, there was a sorcery description of the world, which I didn't know. Don Juan, as a sorcerer and a teacher, taught me that description. The 10-year apprenticeship I've undergone consisted, therefore, in setting up that unknown reality by unfolding its description, adding increasingly more complex parts as I went along. The termination of the apprenticeship meant that I had learned a new description of the world in a convincing and authentic manner, and thus I'd become capable of eliciting a new perception of the world, which matched its new description. In other words, I had gained membership. Don Juan stated that in order to arrive at seeing, one first had to stop the world. Stopping the world was indeed an appropriate rendition of certain states of awareness in which the reality of everyday life is altered because the flow of interpretation, which ordinarily runs uninterruptedly, has been stopped by a set of circumstances alien to that flow. In my case, the set of circumstances alien to my normal flow of interpretations was the sorcery description of the world. Don Juan's precondition for stopping the world was that one had to be convinced. In other words, one had to learn the new description in a total sense for the purpose of pitting it against the old one, and in that way break the dogmatic certainty which we all share that the validity of our perceptions or our reality of the world is not to be questioned. After stopping the world, the next step was seeing. By that, Don Juan meant what I would like to categorize as responding to the perceptual solicitations of a world outside the description we have learned to call reality. My contention is that all these steps can only be understood in terms of the description to which they belong, and since it was a description that he endeavored to give me from the beginning, I must then let his teachings be the only source of entrance into it. Thus, I have left Don Juan's words to speak for themselves. Carlos Castaneda, 1972. Journey to Istlan, The Lessons of Don Juan. Part 1. Stopping the World. 1. Reaffirmations from the world around us. I understand you know a great deal about plants, sir, I said to the old Indian in front of me. A friend of mine had just put us in contact and left the room, and we had introduced ourselves to each other. The old man had told me that his name was Juan Matus. Did your friend tell you that? He asked casually. Yes, he did. I pick plants. Or rather, they let me pick them, he said softly. We were in the waiting room of a bus depot in Arizona. I asked him in very formal Spanish if he would allow me to question him. I said, would the gentleman, caballero, permit me to ask some questions? Caballero, which is derived from the word caballo, or horse, originally meant horseman or a nobleman on horseback. He looked at me inquisitively. I'm a horseman without a horse, he said with a big smile, and then he added, I've told you that my name is Juan Matus. I liked his smile. I thought that, obviously, he was a man that could appreciate directness, and I decided to boldly tackle him with a request. I told him I was interested in collecting and studying medicinal plants. I said that my special interest was the uses of the hallucinogenic cactus, peyote, which I had studied at length at the university in Los Angeles.
I thought that my presentation was very serious. I was very contained and sounded perfectly credible to myself. The old man shook his head slowly, and I, encouraged by his silence, added that it would no doubt be profitable for us to get together and talk about peyote. It was at that moment that he lifted his head and looked me squarely in the eyes. It was a formidable look. Yet it wasn't menacing or awesome in any way. It was a look that went through me. I became tongue-tied at once and couldn't continue with the harangues about myself. That was the end of our meeting. Yet he left on a note of hope. He said that perhaps I could visit him at his house someday. It would be difficult to assess the impact of Don Juan's look if my inventory of experience is not somehow brought to bear on the uniqueness of that event. When I began to study anthropology and thus met Don Juan, I was already an expert in getting around. I had left my home years before, and that meant in my evaluation that I was capable of taking care of myself. Whenever I was rebuffed, I could usually cajole my way in or make concessions, argue, get angry, or, if nothing succeeded, I would whine or complain. In other words, there was always something I knew I could do under the circumstances, and never in my life had any human being stopped my momentum so swiftly and so definitely as Don Juan did that afternoon. But it wasn't only a matter of being silenced. There had been times when I'd been unable to say a word to my opponent because of some inherent respect I felt for him. Still, my anger or frustration was manifested in my thoughts. Don Juan's look, however, numbed me to the point that I couldn't think coherently. I became thoroughly intrigued with that stupendous look and decided to search for him. I prepared myself for 6 months after that first meeting, reading up on the uses of peyote among the American Indians, especially about the peyote cult of the Indians of the Plains. I became acquainted with every work available, and when I felt I was ready, I went back to Arizona. Saturday, December 17th, 1960. I found his house after making long and taxing inquiries among the local Indians. It was early afternoon when I arrived and parked in front of it. I saw him sitting on a wooden milk crate. He seemed to recognize me and greeted me as I got out of my car. We exchanged social courtesies for a while, and then, in plain terms, I confessed that I'd been very devious with him the first time we had met. I'd boasted that I knew a great deal about peyote, when in reality I knew nothing about it. He stared at me. His eyes were very kind. I told him that for 6 months I'd been reading to prepare myself for our meeting, and that this time I really knew a great deal more. He laughed. Obviously, there was something in my statement which was funny to him. He was laughing at me, and I felt a bit confused and offended. He apparently noticed my discomfort and assured me that, although I had had good intentions, there was really no way to prepare myself for our meeting. I wondered if it would have been proper to ask whether that statement had any hidden meaning, but I didn't. Yet he seemed to be attuned to my feelings and proceeded to explain what he had meant. He said that my endeavors reminded him of a story about some people a certain king had persecuted and killed once upon a time. He said that in the story, the persecuted people were indistinguishable from their persecutors, except that they insisted on pronouncing certain words in a peculiar manner proper only to them. That flaw, of course, was the giveaway. The king posted roadblocks at critical points where an official would ask every man passing by to pronounce a key word. Those who could pronounce it the way the king pronounced it would live, but those who couldn't were immediately put to death. The point of the story was that one day a young man decided to prepare himself for passing the roadblock
by learning to pronounce the test word just as the king liked it. Don Juan said, with a broad smile, that in fact it took the young man 6 months to master such a pronunciation. And then came the day of the great test. The young man very confidently came upon the roadblock and waited for the official to ask him to pronounce the word. At that point, Don Juan very dramatically stopped his recounting and looked at me. His pause was very studied and seemed a bit corny to me, but I played along. I'd heard the theme of the story before. It had to do with Jews in Germany and the way one could tell who was a Jew by the way they pronounced certain words. I also knew the punchline. The young man was going to get caught because the official had forgotten the key word and asked him to pronounce another word, which was very similar, but which the young man had not learned to say correctly. Don Juan seemed to be waiting for me to ask what happened, so I did. "What happened to him?" I asked, trying to sound naive and interested in the story. "The young man, who was truly foxy," he said, "realized that the official had forgotten the key word, and before the man could say anything else, he confessed that he had prepared himself for 6 months." He made another pause and looked at me with a mischievous glint in his eyes. This time, he had turned the tables on me. The young man's confession was a new element, and I no longer knew how the story would end. "Well, what happened then?" I asked, truly interested. "The young man was killed instantly, of course," he said, and broke into a roaring laughter. I liked very much the way he'd entrapped my interest. Above all, I liked the way he had linked that story to my own case. In fact, he seemed to have constructed it to fit me. He was making fun of me in a very subtle and artistic manner. I laughed with him. Afterwards, I told him that no matter how stupid I sounded, I was really interested in learning something about plants. "I like to walk a great deal," he said. I thought he was deliberately changing the topic of conversation to avoid answering me. I didn't want to antagonize him with my insistence. He asked me if I wanted to go with him on a short hike in the desert. I eagerly told him that I would love to walk in the desert. "This is no picnic," he said, in a tone of warning. I told him that I wanted very seriously to work with him. I said that I needed information, any kind of information, on the uses of medicinal herbs, and that I was willing to pay him for his time and effort. "You'll be working for me," I said, "and I'll pay you wages." "How much would you pay me?" he asked. I detected a note of greed in his voice. "Whatever you think is appropriate," I said. "Pay me for my time with your time," he said. I thought he was a most peculiar fellow. I told him I didn't understand what he meant. He replied that there was nothing to say about plants. Thus, to take my money would be unthinkable for him. He looked at me piercingly. "What are you doing in your pocket?" he asked, frowning. "Are you playing with your wanger?" He was referring to my taking notes on a minute pad inside the enormous pockets of my windbreaker. When I told him what I was doing, he laughed heartily. I said that I didn't want to disturb him by writing in front of him. "If you want to write, write," he said. "You don't disturb me." We hiked in the surrounding desert until it was almost dark. He didn't show me any plants, nor did he talk about them at all. We stopped for a moment to rest by some large bushes. "Plants are very peculiar things," he said, without looking at me. "They are alive, and they feel." At the very moment he made that statement, a strong gust of wind shook the desert chaparral around us. The bushes made a rattling noise. "Do you hear that?" he asked me, putting his right hand to his ear as if he were aiding his hearing. "The leaves and the wind are agreeing with me." I laughed. The friend who had put us in contact had already told me to watch out because the old man was very eccentric. I thought the agreement with the leaves was one of his eccentricities. We walked for a while longer, but he still didn't show me any plants, nor did he pick any of them. He simply breezed through the bushes, touching them gently. Then he came to a halt and sat down on a rock and told me to rest and look around. I insisted on talking. Once more, I let him know that I wanted very much to learn about plants, especially peyote. I pleaded with him to become my informant in exchange for some sort of monetary reward. "You don't have to pay me," he said. "You can ask me anything you want. I'll tell you what I know, and then I'll tell you what to do with it." He asked me if I agreed with the arrangement. I was delighted. Then he added a cryptic statement. "Perhaps there's nothing to learn about plants, because there's nothing to say about them." I didn't understand what he'd said or what he'd meant by it. "What did you say?" I asked. He repeated the statement 3 times, and then the whole area was shaken by the roar of an Air Force jet flying low. "There! The world has just agreed with me," he said, putting his left hand to his ear. I found him very amusing. His laughter was contagious. "Are you from Arizona, Don Juan?" I asked, in an effort to keep the conversation centered around his being my informant. He looked at me and nodded affirmatively. His eyes seemed to be tired. I could see the white underneath his pupils. "Were you born in this locality?" He nodded his head again without answering me. It seemed to be an affirmative gesture, but it also seemed to be the nervous head shake of a person who's thinking. "And where are you from, yourself?" he asked. "I come from South America," I said. "That's a big place. Do you come from all of it?" His eyes were piercing again as he looked at me. I began to explain the circumstances of my birth, but he interrupted me. "We're alike in this respect," he said. "I live here now, but I'm really a Yaqui from Sonora."
"Is that so? I myself come from..."
He didn't let me finish.
I know, he said. "You are who you are, from wherever you are, as I am a Yaqui from Sonora."
His eyes were very shiny, and his laughter was strangely unsettling. He made me feel as if he'd caught me in a lie. I experienced a peculiar sensation of guilt. I had the feeling he knew something I didn't know, or didn't want to tell. My strange embarrassment grew. He must have noticed it, for he stood up and asked me if I wanted to go eat in a restaurant in town. Walking back to his home and then driving into town made me feel better, but I wasn't quite relaxed. I somehow felt threatened, although I couldn't pinpoint the reason. I wanted to buy him some beer in the restaurant. He said that he never drank, not even beer. I laughed to myself. I didn't believe him. The friend who had put us in contact had told me that the old man was plastered out of his mind most of the time. I really didn't mind if he was lying to me about not drinking. I liked him. There was something very soothing about his person. I must have had a look of doubt on my face, for he then went on to explain that he used to drink in his youth, but that one day he simply dropped it.
"People hardly ever realize that we can cut anything from our lives, anytime, just like that."
He snapped his fingers. "Do you think that one can stop smoking or drinking that easily?" I asked.
"Sure," he said, with great conviction. "Smoking and drinking are nothing. Nothing at all, if we want to drop them."
At that very moment, the water that was boiling in the coffee percolator made a loud perking sound.
Hear that?
Don Juan exclaimed with a shine in his eyes.
The boiling water agrees with me.
Then he added after a pause,
a man can get agreements from everything around him.
At that crucial instant, the coffee percolator made a truly obscene gurgling sound. He looked at the percolator and softly said,
thank you,
nodded his head, and then broke into a roaring laughter. I was taken aback. His laughter was a bit too loud, but I was genuinely amused by it all. My first real session with my informant ended then. He said goodbye at the door of the restaurant. I told him I had to visit some friends and that I would like to see him again at the end of the following week. When will you be home? I asked. He scrutinized me.
Whenever you come, he replied.
I don't know exactly when I can come.
Just come then, and don't worry.
What if you're not in?
I'll be there, he said, smiling, and walked away.
I ran after him and asked him if he would mind my bringing a camera with me to take pictures of him in his house.
That's out of the question, he said, with a frown.
How about a tape recorder? Would you mind that?
I'm afraid there's no possibility of that either.
I became annoyed and began to fret. I said I saw no logical reason for his refusal. Don Juan shook his head negatively.
Forget it, he said forcefully, and if you still want to see me, don't ever mention it again.
I staged a weak final complaint. I said that pictures and recordings were indispensable to my work. He said that there was only one thing which was indispensable for anything we did. He called it the spirit.
One can't do without the spirit, he said, and you don't have it. Worry about that, and not about pictures.
What do you... He interrupted me with a movement of his hand and walked backwards a few steps.
Be sure to come back, he said softly, and waved goodbye.